superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
I've seen fire and I've seen rain.
We absolutely saw rain in Duluth this week, and the fires in Maui also evoked a local connection.
In the Lahaina fire, they basically had gone through a long dry period. In the fires of 1918, it was a two-year drought.
We'll hear comparisons to and lessons from the fires of 1918. Plus, his music spans genres, with a nod to the inland seas.
So when I did country western music, I put a cowboy hat on, and then when I did sea shanties, I did a sailing cap on.
We'll catch up with John Agagi. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. The wildfires that devastated the Hawaiian island of Maui and virtually erased the town of Lahaina was described as the worst blaze in the United States since 1918. That reference should be familiar to many in our area, as the fires of 1918, the blazes that raged from Moose Lake to Duluth, stopping just short of Superior. Dan Reed is a local historian from the Moose Lake area who has done extensive work chronicling the history of those fires, including firsthand accounts of those who survived them. And he joins me now. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, Dan.
Oh, thank you.
So when people heard the comparison of Maui to 1918, did locals know exactly what they were talking about? And what was your reaction to the Maui blaze?
It was amazing how many similarities, even through the ages, fire is still fire. Mm-hmm. And it has very similar imprints, the reactions to it. Some people can't believe it's happening. Other people have been worried about it for a period of time. Everyone's caught unawares, and people who make the wrong decision, the wrong move, wait too long, whatever, that's where the tragedy comes.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like, unfortunately, the failure to learn from history. One of the major concerns of wildfires, of course, is the cause, ranging from careless campers to actions or accidents by various utility companies to Mother Nature. So what caused the Moose Lake fire of 1918, and what, again, were the similarities to Maui, if any?
In the Lahaina fire, they basically had gone through a long dry period. In the fires of 1918, it was a two-year drought.
Mm-hmm.
And then all it took was the winds, which is typical in the fall, speeded up, and the humidity in the air dropped to at least desert levels. And once it starts pushing the flames, it races on. And the fires were burning here. Lahaina basically happens basically the same day. They have a utility transformer explodes, and they fight that fire, think they got it out, and then another one's going on away from the Lahaina area. They go there to take care of that. Meanwhile, the other one reignites, and Lahaina is gone. But in Minnesota, the fires were burning almost 2 months before the big blaze came on Columbus Day, October the 12th in 1918. And the main cause that had fires that they couldn't put out is because it was the age of coal-burning steam engines, locomotives on the Soo Line and the NP railways. And there was stretches of the rail lines that were completely on fire, never quit burning. There wasn't enough labor there to put out the flames because it was wartime. The railroads were nationalized. Everything was geared to war production, and they were sending trainloads and trainloads of materials east for the war machine. And there was no military. There was no National Guard. There was nothing. Those that were fighting the fire were all regional people.
Hmm.
It isn't quite like the Barnum fire that was here a week ago or so that burned 80 acres.
Right.
This one basically burned 1,500 square miles in northeastern Minnesota, which it basically in places spotty over an area of 8,400 square miles. But these fires, even with the modern technology that we have, when the ground is burning itself, you know, they're very, very hard to put out. The farm I was raised on, the old guy, who then was young, had been clearing some of the land on that farm. And north of the house, he had cleared out an area that summer because it was so dry, pulled all the rocks, pulled all the stumps. The fire comes through in the fall, burns the very ground that he had just plowed. And he estimated it probably burnt 5 feet off of that particular piece of ground. The unfortunate thing about it is there was another layer of stones and another layer of stumps to pick before he could start using the same land.
Well, you mentioned the Barnum Fire, which, as we're recording this earlier in the week, I think it's out right finally by the rains that finally came. But, you know, again, that accentuates how very real this is and the connection to the Maui or the Lahaina Fire. We're speaking with Dan Reed. He's a local historian in Moose Lake and a major chronicler of the fires of 1918 there and in Duluth. And I mentioned that it stopped short of Superior, but Superior did play a role in the relief efforts, I understand.
You know, as the railroads were set out at the time, the Soo Line, for example, and some of the NP rail traffic all went through Superior and the Superior yards. And so when the word came that, you know, the whole countryside was burning, they sent relief trains from there. They commandeered trains for that were doing regular business, as much as they could, sending whatever cars they could hook up. They sent from Superior, Duluth. Cloquet itself, for example, is a town about the same size as Lahaina is now. And they literally loaded up everybody in a couple of railroad trains. So the story went, you know, the police finally had some of the railroad people at gunpoint said, you're going to get out of here with these people. And so they saved all the life in Cloquet except for a handful. Some were too stubborn to go. But as they went towards Superior, sides of the railroad tracks were burning, and in places, cars were catching on fire, and you'd go through areas where the smoke was so thick you couldn't see the car in front of you. And they were really lucky to get through. But they had about the same population as Lahaina, and Lahaina had one road in and one road out. A lot of the timber towns in northern Minnesota at the time had one road in and one road out. And so when you have these kind of disasters, you better leave early or you're not going to make it at all.
Wow.
And this particular fire is the largest natural disaster in Minnesota for loss of life. And it's second in the United States. The only one that's bigger than this one for loss of life is the Peshtigo Fire on the east side of Wisconsin, bordering Lake Michigan. And the only reason they don't talk about the Peshtigo Fire very often, and that was in a logging area many years before the 1918 fire, reason that that isn't talked about is because that was the same day that Chicago burned.
Right, right. Which, by the way, having been a, well, I'm a native Chicagoan and fifth generation at that, and my ancestors indeed ran to the lake holding the baby. But the themes that you say just keep resonating because that year in 1871, they were suffering a drought. And this was October 1871, and you would think October in Chicago should be a pretty cool time. But
in Duluth, a Superior had the bay to shelter it, but there was fireballs going through the air, and the railroad bridge burned between Duluth and Superior during this whole episode and that. But Lester Park and Woodland burned to the ground, and the flames came so close that there was huge waves of flames at the top of the hills in Duluth. And a lot of the Duluth population was getting into the lake in the bay and that. I heard accounts from people that were along Garfield Avenue, and they were in the lake there. There was burning debris falling all over the place, and a lot of the burning leaves and forest that was burning and blowing in the air was leaving waves of like snow over everything in the smoke. And so it came to that point, they thought, well, Duluth is going to go, and they were starting to think they have to move farther into the lake. And the wind died because the fire had come too late to get over the hill before there's that natural cooling from the lake in evening. And the wind went down, and the fire receded.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Dan Reed. He's a local historian in Moose Lake and a major chronicler of the fires of 1918 there and in Duluth. Your work and that of others on the fires is preserved in the Fires of 1918 Museum in Moose Lake. I took a visit recently, and Diane Olson, one of your colleagues there, was gracious enough to give us a walkthrough. Let's hear some of what she had to say.
My name is Diane Olson. I'm a volunteer archivist at the Fires of 1918 Museum. We have over here examples of some of the equipment that they needed that day, trying to put out one fire and another fire. There were like two areas, Brookston at milepost 62 and Tamarack, and it just ignited the fire heading out to the various townships in the Moose Lake, Kettle River area, and the milepost 62, it headed up towards the Cloquet-Duluth fire.
It did not get into Wisconsin. It looks like it got right to the border, and that was it.
Well, actually, it got up to Lakeside, and the wind changed off Lake Superior and basically snuffed out that fire. So it did not, but Superior played a very important role in the relief efforts. They were triaging all the victims that were transported into Duluth, and many were sent over to Superior, where folks opened up their homes and their hearts to taking care of these individuals until they were able to get back on their feet.
And this was during the pandemic too.
Yes, with the Spanish flu. I mean, they had so many things going on. This is a display that it's a very surreal display. It is the artifacts that remained at the sites where we lost fire victims had passed away. And you can see where the coin is melted. And yet you can see it's an irony. Here's a quilt, beautiful dishes, and the contrast. There was a area up on Highway 2773 called Dead Man's Curve. We do have the original historic sign up there. And that's where one car, through the smoke and all the confusion of things, piled into the ditch. Another car piled into the ditch. People died at that site. Very, very sad. We're looking at here the Home Guard. They were kind of the security, but they were also the recovery, finding the fire victims. Here we have a listing of the fire victims of the 1918 fire.
And how many?
453. Hmm. We have them listed, the name, the age, the areas, Carlton County, Aitkin County, township, residence, St. Louis County, and Pine County. We have a chronology here. it gives you an idea of what's happening. October 4th, sparks from a train ignite fire near Tamarack in Aitkin County, northwest of Kettle River, becoming main source of Moose Lake area fire. October 10th, sparks from a train ignite another fire at milepost 62 near Brookston, becoming main source of the Cloquet-Duluth fire. Now, October 12th, a cool front enters Minnesota from northwest. High winds blowing in and dropping humidity, two natural elements fueling a fire. By 1:30 p.m., Moose Lake and Cloquet-Duluth fires began moving. 3:30, first known death reported, Laura Meetinen, thrown from a fleeing car near Brookston. 4 o'clock, winds exceed 75 miles per hour. Sky becomes so dark with smoke that street lights turn on. 6:15, fire reaches Kettle River. Attempting to drive away from the fire, 75 to 100 people die at Dead Man's Curb, south of Kettle River. 7 o'clock, the fire reaches Duluth. And at 7:30, fire reaches Moose Lake. 8 o'clock, fire reaches Cloquet. 10 o'clock, fire chases last relief train out of Cloquet. People took off on foot by roads and through the woods. Many found refuge in lakes with wildlife and livestock. Imagine trying to swim out there and you're going to see probably bears and whatever. They were in trouble too. Believing the underground would be protection from the flames, many people, unfortunately, suffocated in wells, cave-like holes, and root cellars.
And that was local historian Diane Olson at the Fires of 1918 Museum in Moose Lake. The museum is closed for the season, but volunteers are always willing to provide information by calling 218-485-4234. Once again, 218-485-4234. And one of those volunteers is our guest, Dan Reed. So what sort of lessons or warnings should we be taking from 100-odd years ago and very, very recent history coming up the last week?
Well, within a year or two before the fire, the forestry people in the state of Minnesota felt that all the debris being left by logging and that should be burned so that there wasn't a large fire danger in the spring or the fall. Unfortunately, during this dry period, even some of that burning ended up in the peat bog areas and that were bone dry.
And you're speaking of controlled burns,
right?
Which Native peoples did for centuries in the Americas.
Yeah, and the problem we have these days is that we're very successful at following the policies of Smokey the Bear. And Smokey the Bear basically says, you know, you're just not going to use fire. You leave it natural. The problem with that, a lot of our areas have grown up. And so this fire they had, for example, in Northern California and that, if they would have done fire breaks and that sort of thing over the years and getting rid of the material otherwise that was building up in that, they might not have lost that town and that whole area. You leave too much debris lying around and too many layers of dried grass in the swamps and that, and before you know it, it starts on fire at the most inopportune time.
Right. Well, we've been speaking with Dan Reed. He's a local historian in Moose Lake and a major chronicler of the fires of 1918 there and in Duluth. Thank you for joining us, Dan.
Thank you very much, and I feel sorry for the families of Lahaina because as the old ones were so affected by the fire and in their time, and they always talked about events in their lives before and after the fire, how much their lives have changed. The families of Lahaina will have to mark their lives in the same way.
Coming up, his repertoire includes sea shanties, including the Inland Seas.
When first I landed in Liverpool, I went out on a spree. me money, alas, I spent it fast, got drunk as drunk could be.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. What do country music, a touch of classical, and sea shanties have in common? Well, they're all forms of music, of course, and basically use the same notes. But if you want to find someone who can play them all, you might try John Akaki. He's a singer-songwriter from South Range, and still lives in the area, and who hit the regional and national stage with his work on public radio's A Prairie Home Companion in his heyday a few years back. He's also worked for TV and film, catching the eye, if not ear, of a Hollywood executive or two. But we're fortunate to have him as a regular in our area, playing everywhere from the Deck, where he performs sea shanties this week, to Silver Bay next month. And he joins me now. Welcome to Wisconsin Public Radio, John Akaki.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
So you've got all these different genres. Do you normally perform just one, like you just did the sea shanties, or do you offer a potpourri, or does it depend on the venue or the audience?
It depends on the venue and the audience.
And the music you remember to bring, right?
Well, a lot of it I have in my head. I don't use a stand usually, except for maybe a set list. For example, at the Homegrown, I played several different types of music. So when I did country western music, I put a cowboy hat on. And then when I did sea shanties, I did a sailing cap on. And so that kept everything straight for everybody and for me too.
Which one did you wear when you went and sat at the bar later on?
I'm not sure. I don't
a beret, yes.
A beret, that could be, yes, that could be.
Well, I think at the heart of it is guitar picking. So tell us your beginnings of that.
Oh, my goodness, where would I start? My first instrument was a hand-me-down guitar from a cousin. And we're a fairly musical family, so family reunions are really hootenannies. So I learned guitar on my own. I had maybe one lesson from a cousin, and he taught me some basic chords, and that was it. And I grew up fairly isolated in the country where, to visit a friend was, what the heck, hour and a half walk or more. So I had a lot of time on my hands. And so I really didn't take lessons until much later. And I was fortunate to be involved with a seminar with the famed Irish guitarist, John Doyle, singer-songwriter. And so I studied with him at that seminar and was introduced to various alternate tunings. And then also met with Paul Brady, a famous Irish singer. That was really the only formal instruction I've ever had on the guitar. The only formal instruction I've ever had on any instruments. I took piano lessons from a cousin who studied to be a concert pianist, actually. But that was fairly short, maybe less than a year. And then I studied violin with Steve Hyland, who's with the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra.
Sure.
And I played with the UWS Chamber Orchestra. I can't say that I was the greatest player because most of those musicians, they started when they were really young. I didn't start violin until I was 30, but I always wanted to play it.
So I was going to ask, where's the touch of classical come in? I guess you just said that.
Well, and then my mother, too. When I was a kid, she bought a 20-volume set of the Golden Treasury of Music, and it had every genre from classical to gospel, to folk music, to Celtic music. And so the classical music, there was a booklet that came along with it, and I would listen to classical music. And I remember my dad said from the kitchen, "Where did you get that stuff from?" And my mother said, "I bought that for those kids." So that was an early introduction.
All right. Well, I think we should hear a bit. Let's start with an instrumental piece. You Know How Much I Miss You. You want to set this up for us?
Yes. That was a piece that was inspired during COVID. I had two friends. I used to live in Germany, and two of the musicians passed away, and one of them passed away from COVID. He was a classically trained guitarist. So I wrote this song in memory of both of them, actually.
Well, let's hear You Know How Much I Miss You by John Akaki. Thank you. And that was You Know How Much I Miss You by our guest, John Agaki of South Range. He has a show. He always has a show in the area somewhere. And he recently had one just this week at the deck performing sea shanties. So first of all, tell me, is it shanties or shanties? And by that, I mean, is it with a C? Right. Or is it S-H-A-N-T-I-E-S? Or maybe it's not T-I-E-S either, right? I mean, maybe T-Y-S. So anyway, is it with an S or a C?
It can be spelled both ways. The C-H spelling comes from the French, so chanté, to sing.
Okay, great. I'm going to go with the French one because that's what the guy in the beret at the bar told me.
I see.
Well, so how did you get into them?
Oh, that's another curious story. You know, I used to work on ships. When I was living in Europe, I actually was on some of the clipper ships in Belgium. And then I worked at Fraser Shipyards as well, you know. And so part of that also has to do with that whole Celtic influence, because many sea shanties are British or Irish. And in fact, my sea shanty show that I do at Russo's in November, this will be the third annual one coming up, I'll be doing sea shanties that start in the British Isles. Then I go down to Canada, North America, and go to Mexico.
Well, that's exactly. Well, no, don't go to Mexico yet, because I want to go up the St. Lawrence Seaway and bring you right back home. So are these applicable to our inland seas? Do we have sea shanties that are about our area?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's one shanty I did at the Harvest Fest at the Bayfront, Randy Dandio, and that was very popular in Nova Scotia. And, you know, there's even a line in there, soon we'll be heading down through the locks, you know, so hey, roll and go. So it does apply, absolutely.
Well, on this side of the locks, we can hear you. You're right, you were at Bayfront and recently at the deck, and Woosels is coming up in November. But we got one right now. Here is Go to Sea No More by John Agaki.
When first I landed in Liverpool, I went out on a spree. Me money, alas, I spent it fast, got drunk as drunk could be. And when me money was all gone, 'twas then that I wanted more. But a man must be blind to make up his mind to go to sea once more. Once more, boys, once more, go to sea once more. But a man must be blind to make up his mind to go to sea once more. I spent that night with Angelie, too drunk to roll in bed. Me watch was new and made money too, in the morning was when she fled. I walk the streets about, the whores they all did roar. There goes Jack Sprat, the poor sailor lad, he must go to sea once more. Once more, boys, once more, go to sea once more. There goes Jack Sprat, the poor sailor lad, he must go to sea once more. As I walked the streets about, I met with Sir Arthur Brown. I asked him for to take me on, and he looked at me with a frown. He says, last time you was paid up with me, you could not score. But I'll give you a chance, and I'll take your advance, and I'll send you to sea once more. Once more, boys, once more, send you to sea once more. But I'll give you a chance, and I'll take your advance, and I'll send you to sea once more. He shipped me on board an old whaling ship bound for the Arctic Sea, where the cold wind blows through the frost and snow, and Jamaican rum would freeze. But worse to bear, I had no weather gear, for I spent all me money on shore. 'Twas then that I wished that I was dead and could go to sea no more. No more, boys, no more, go see no more. 'Twas then that I wished that I was dead and could go to sea no more. So come all ye bold seafaring men who listens to me song. When ye go on those long trips, I'll have ye not go wrong. Take my advice, take no strong drink, don't go sleeping with them whores. Get married instead and spend all night in bed and go to sea no more. No more, boys, no more. Go to sea no more. Get married instead and spend all night in bed and go to sea no more.
And that was Go to Sea No More. You don't have to go to the real seas. You can go to the unsalted seas right here by John Agaki, our guest.
Can I just give an aside, because you did mention about the Great Lakes?
Sure.
I was interviewed by KTWH in Two Harbors, and on the way there, I knew I would be interviewed in the Edna G in the captain's quarters. Mm-hmm. And so I pulled over and I wrote a song about the Edna G and played it at their cabin.
Well, you know, you are not the first person to write a song about the Edna G. In fact, on this show, we have had Eddie Ojard. He just had his birthday the other day. I believe he turned 15. Yes, he's got more albums than you at that age. I'm not making it up.
He does. He's great.
And he indeed has songs about practically every boat that ever docked in Two Harbors, some of which the Edward H. is named for one of his forebears for whom he is named as Edward H. Ojard.
Nice.
So I imagine we'll hear your Edna G. song in yet another performance of Sea Shanties you have coming up in November at Wusso's in Duluth.
Yeah, absolutely. This will be the third annual Sea Shanty show at Wusso's. That'll be coming up November 18th at 7 p.m. And I'll be joined with Linda Crumpton, a really wonderful concertina player. And I'll be doing, you know, a variety of sea shanties from north to south.
Well, we're definitely going to hear more of this. I envision that we'll have an all-sea shanty show at some point. How about something in a bluesy vein? You've got something called Blues Go Away. Want to tell us about that one?
Yes, that is a song that I wrote where you think it's going to be a blues song just by the title, but it's actually a very happy song. And it's about finding love after having the blues, you know, and being jilted. Then you find someone, and then all of a sudden the whole world is beautiful again.
All right. And here is Blues Go Away by John Agaki.
I got somebody who really loves me, and I don't need your tears or your sympathy. Oh, blues go away and let go of me. You always were there when I really was down, when I was at my worst, you were always around. It's true you have been my best bad weather friend, but right now I sure hope I don't see you again. So blues go away, I'm setting you free. There's others in need of your sad company. Someone sure needs you now, and it sure isn't me. So blues, find your way to your next misery. Now the sun, it is shining so bright in the sky, and it's nice to not have all those tears in my eyes. Up above there's this beautiful blue, not the grays and the darkness that I got from you. So please go away and just let me be. I don't need you now, and you sure don't need me. And I'm making you blue from the loving you see. So blues go away. Free. Mm-hmm. Do 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 do.
And that was Blues Go Away by our guest, John Agaki, one of his many varieties of music. Can you tell us where we can find out more about it?
You can go to my website, johnagakimusic.com, and you'll see video clips and where I'll be playing and selections of my music, and John Agaki Music Facebook page also. And those are a couple of places you can head to.
All right. And John is normal spelling, J-O-H-N. And Agaki is AGACKI.com. We'll go out with an instrumental homage to the Inland Sea, Lake Superior Shore. And by the way, I think Eddie Ojard has written one of those too. Been speaking, not with Eddie, I think we're getting a great commercial for him, with John Agaki of South Range. Thank you for joining us, John.
Oh, you're welcome. This was great. Thank you very much.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and we're joined by Rick Lubbers of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
And Shalon Monroe, multimedia journalist for WDIO-TV. Hello, Shalon.
Hi, Robin.
So, Shalon, earlier in the show, we heard all about the similarities between the Maui fires and our own fires of 1918. Did the fire last week in Barnum finally get under control?
Yes, it did. On Tuesday, the heavy downpour that came overnight from Monday, about 0.4 inches of rain helped those crews contain that fire 100%. Now, all the evacuation orders that were in place, along with the road closures, have been lifted. The fire forced the evacuations of 6 residents and burned approximately 82 acres.
All right. Well, as the song says, and you just alluded to, we've seen fire and we've seen rain, a lot of it this week.
Yes, Robin, we had a lot of rain Monday afternoon into overnight Tuesday as flooding occurred throughout the city, especially if you were in the downtown area on Tuesday near Superior Street. Construction was actually in that area, but because of the flood overnight, there was construction materials that were spreaded out where crews had to come in and try to get that area cleaned up so they could open up Superior Street that afternoon, but it was closed Tuesday morning. A WDIO colleague of mine spoke to an operations coordinator with MDOT, and he said that there was a few washouts throughout the town, and both West Duluth and East Duluth sustained flooding and damages, but there was nothing that was to the degree or even close to what happened down on Superior Street. But areas alongside the Whole Food Co-op and Central Hillside, right there is a culvert behind that building. Some of those neighbors had to be evacuated because water came up over the culvert. But in the end, there were no injuries to report, and some people were able to get back into their property Tuesday afternoon. But it was definitely a flooding washout scene throughout the Duluth area.
All right. Well, Rick, on the Wisconsin side, a Superior man was sentenced this week for a really unimaginable crime.
Yes, Jacob Cole Johnson of Superior received the maximum sentence for killing and dismembering his friend, Ricky Belzimo Jr. Johnson fired at least 4 shots that killed his friend in a moving car on Father's Day 2021 in the Twin Cities area. He then subsequently drove the body several hours north to the Twin Ports and enlisted the help of several others to dismember and dispose of the remains in Lake Superior. For this, he was handed the statutory maximum sentence for second-degree murder. In imposing the 40-year prison term, Judge Michael Kuzel said the case was so horrific that it's hard to even describe without my stomach churning. Johnson, who declined to speak at the hearing, mostly looked towards the bench and avoided facing several Eljimo family members as they described an immeasurable level of grief that has shown few signs of subsiding more than 2 years later. Belzimo, a 34-year-old father of three, was riding in the car with Johnson and two women when he was killed. Defense attorneys presented evidence that Belzimo was under the influence of meth, threatening people, and waving around a knife in a manner that caused Johnson to shoot in self-defense. But prosecutors portrayed Johnson as angry and annoyed with the victim, irrationally choosing to shoot without any warning. A Duluth jury agreed in early August, finding 37-year-old Johnson guilty of both intentional and unintentional murder. Johnson eventually took the body to an RV in rural Douglas County and cut it up with a circular saw. He received assistance from a friend, Robert Thomas West, who purchased supplies and helped dispose of the evidence. West then drove the remains up the North Shore to Grand Portage and threw the buckets from a fishing boat commissioned by another friend, Tommy Lynn Hintz. Now, West has received a 15-year sentence for his role as he was found guilty by a jury in February of aiding an offender as an accomplice to second-degree murder and interference with a dead body. Tommy Lynn Hintz, meanwhile, agreed to cooperate in trials of both men and was placed on 5 years of supervised probation as part of a plea agreement to aiding an offender. She was also ordered to serve two 90-day jail stints, but may have those waived as she maintains sobriety and a productive lifestyle. While Monday's sentencing ended more than 2 years of litigation in Minnesota, additional business remains in Wisconsin, where both Johnson and West are charged with mutilating a corpse. Johnson additionally faces a count of possession of a firearm by a felon.
Well, also from Superior, former gymnastics coach pleaded guilty to child sexual assault charges, this time in St. Louis County.
That's the third jurisdiction in which he has now been convicted. 50-year-old George Francis Deppa entered the pleas to felony second degree and gross misdemeanor fifth degree criminal sexual conduct in separate cases. In entering the pleas, Deppa asserted that he was unable to recall the specific circumstances of the offenses due to intoxication or amnesia, but acknowledged there would be proof beyond a reasonable doubt if the cases proceeded to trial. Deppa, formerly a coach at Twin Ports Gymnastics, previously pleaded guilty to a federal child pornography charge in U.S. District Court in Minnesota and two child sexual assault cases in Douglas County. Authorities have identified a total of five victims. Under the terms of a global plea agreement reached in June, Deppa is expected to eventually face a total of 20 to 25 years in prison. Under questioning Tuesday, Deppa did not dispute an allegation that he provided sleep drug Ambien to a girl when she was 13 or 14 years old. In the other matter, Deppa likewise acknowledged evidence that he had inappropriately touched the other victim when she was 17. A criminal complaint in that case also states that he crushed up a white pill and provided it to the victim prior to the assault. Deppa said he did not clearly recall if he read that part in discovery, though the defendant and prosecutor agreed that it was immaterial to the charge. Another case against Deppa alleging two counts of first-degree criminal sexual conduct was dismissed as that conduct was already covered by his federal plea. In admitting to production of child pornography in June, Deppa acknowledged taking photographs while coercing a 15-year-old girl to engage in sexual conduct. Court documents said he subjected that victim to inhumane conditions, routinely drugging the girl before molesting or raping her from the approximate ages of 8 to 16. Deppa also pleaded no contest in Douglas County Circuit Court last month to two counts of second-degree sexual assault of a child and one count of exposing genitals to a child. A third count of second-degree sexual assault of a child was dismissed. In those cases, authorities said he sexually touched two teenage students while they were out for rides in his boat during sleepovers at his Superior home. A third Wisconsin victim also came forward after seeing news coverage of his May 2021 arrest, saying Deppa inappropriately touched her during a private coaching session. Deppa in May was found competent to proceed in court after being ordered last November to undergo a competency evaluation in the federal case. He told Senior Judge John DeSanto on Tuesday that he is taking seven medications and is awaiting a diagnosis regarding potential mental illness. But he said he was thinking clearly and understood the ramifications of entering the pleas. Now, Deppa's sentence in Minnesota will have little practical effect, though, as any time will run concurrent to lengthier sentences to be handed down by the federal and Wisconsin judges. The global agreement stipulates that prosecutors in both jurisdictions will seek no more than 25 years in prison, while defense attorneys will argue for no less than 20 years. Deppa will be sentenced in federal court in St. Paul on November 15, in St. Louis County on December 14, and in Douglas County on December 20.
Finally, back in Duluth, also on the criminal justice front, city councilors authorized the police department to purchase an armored vehicle.
Yes, they did. Despite initial misgivings, Duluth city councilors voted 8-0 on Monday in support of police department's plan to purchase an armored Bearcat rescue vehicle for more than $377,000. While Second District Councilor Mike Mayall expressed concern with the use of militarized or sort of escalated tactics during actions of protest, he said local police leadership largely allayed those fears through a public outreach effort prior to requesting the purchase of the vehicle. Duluth Police pledged to consult with community members as the department puts together a policy governing when and where the armored vehicle may be deployed. They assured councilors that a policy would be adopted well before officers take delivery of the machine. The build-out of the vehicle will take about a year to complete. The purchase will not require additional expenditures from the city's general fund, but will instead come from a previously approved police budget, as the department will finish the year with surplus funds due to several positions that have gone unfilled. The vehicle features a patented roof hatch system, which can be rapidly secured for bulletproof protection. The department does not currently have an armored vehicle and has called on the Superior Police Department for assistance in dangerous emergency situations. The armored vehicle from Superior, also a Bearcat, operates under its own local command. But Duluth will now exercise full authority if and when an armored presence is required.
All right. Well, we've been joined by Rick Lubbers, executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
And Shalon Monroe, multimedia journalist for WDIO-TV. Thank you, Shalon.
Thank you, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org, DuluthNewsTribune.com, and WDIO.com. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. We leave you with more of the music of John Agaki. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.
I've been thinking about the times we've spent, love. Thinking about all the places that we've been. I've been thinking about the times we've spent, love.